This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
When you have to stop but don't really want to, stop at BP. Because BP has everything you need to keep it going. Fuel to keep the adventures going. The BP Me app to keep the savings and the commutes going. Snacks and drinks to keep the crew going. And the BP Me Rewards Visa to keep the rewards going and going and going. A stop at BP isn't a stop at all. Keep it going.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
This episode, I spoke to Dr. Richard Barry of NASA's Goddard Flight Center to find out how the Hubble Space Telescope changed our view of the universe and why finding life beyond Earth isn't a matter of if, but when.
Well, I am Richard Barry. I am a research astronomer in the Laboratory for Exoplanets and Stellar Astrophysics at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. I'm also the observatory project scientist for Hubble Space Telescope.
Thanks very much for speaking to me today, Richard. It's great to have you on the podcast. Yeah, I was wanting to sort of start off by talking about the Hubble Space Telescope, because you're the observatory project scientist on the mission, as you just said. What does that role actually involve?
My primary purpose is to keep a very close eye on Hubble Space Telescope as its components age. So it's been 30 years since we launched it. Actually, I was the person that launched Hubble Space Telescope from Kennedy Space Center. I used to be a space shuttle engineer back in the day. And so I was the guy who was sitting on launch console when we launched it. So it's been a long time. And these, amazingly, it just keeps working. And it just is, it's an amazing piece of hardware. But to try to make sure that we can use it for as long as possible, because it has a very important science that it can do in tandem with James Webb's Space Telescope. So James Webb works primarily in the infrared, near and mid-infrared wavelength ranges, whereas Hubble can work in optical and the UV ranges. And so there is a really good dynamism between those two observatories. So my job really is to try to understand changes in Hubble Space Telescope in the observatory parts of it. So the gyros, the high gain antenna, the pointing systems, watch those things very closely and to try to adapt as it changes.
That's really, really interesting. And it's especially interesting because I think you do hear quite a lot nowadays talk of when's Hubble going to retire, you know, and then JWST labeled as a successor. It seems like it's Hubble doesn't have long to go. But would you disagree with that?
I would really disagree. It's And it's not just because I love Hubble so much. It's just been an amazing fire hose of science data for astronomy. But it, as I mentioned, there is this dynamism. And so James Webb Space Telescope, it will be looking for first stars, and it's going to be looking for exoplanets around other stars. And there are many very important things that Hubble still can contribute while observing simultaneously with JW. I'll just call James Webb Space Telescope, we refer to as JW at NASA. So it has, Hubble Space Telescope has a lot to say about that. So for instance, suppose that we're interested in studying the stellar companion of a known exoplanet, a new exoplanet, and we want to know what the environment of that exoplanet is. A lot of that, you can't really tell very much about the star in the infrared. Whereas in the UV, you can see if the star has flaring activity. Most of the stars in the universe are these, what are called M dwarfs, or these little dim red stars. And so most of the exoplanets that we'll find will be around these dim red stars. And they are often chromospherically very active. And you can't tell until you look in the UV. So if you parked a small planet and a civilization next to one of these stars, it would be simply sterilized every 3 or 4 days, just completely sterilized by these flares. So it'd be a horrible place to look for life. So before we go and start drilling in on any particular planet, we should just check with Hubble Space Telescope, see if it's going to be a good place to put life or not, before we even bother to look. So that's just one example. But those capabilities, the dynamism between the two observatories is just beautiful.
And isn't it incredible that, I'm pretty sure I've got this right, that at the time the Hubble Space Telescope was conceived of, the first exoplanet hadn't been discovered. That's correct, isn't it? So it's not even as if Hubble was designed to look for exoplanets. It's sort of, its versatility really comes across, doesn't it, when you look at it doing something that it wasn't actually designed for?
Right. Yeah, they exoplanets were just a concept when we launched Hubble back in 90. So the first exoplanet detected was 51 Pegasi, which was back in 1995. So it has turned out that we... Oh, and a very interesting, this is another thing that we might want to discuss. We've just detected a new stellar mass black hole using Hubble Space Telescope and gravitational microlensing. So very cool result from Hubble. And that was just this past week. So these small stellar mass black holes are very hard to detect. The universe should be just full of them. But we now have direct evidence and a measurement of a mass, of a stellar mass black hole using Hubble. So you're just not going to get that with other types of telescopes. So let's see. I think I've rather forgotten what the question was, but did I ever answer? That's just like me. I'll go running off. My poor students call it a coffee-fueled sermon. I just wander off and start talking about whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you did, yeah. I mean, it was really just that notion that Hubble wasn't designed, you know, to look for exoplanets, but here we are.
Yeah. Such a, you know, the suite of instruments on Hubble Space Telescope, one of the beautiful things about it is that we've been able to grapple it with a space shuttle and replace the instrument suite, or at least parts of it, over time. And adapt to whatever direction science is going, because there are a lot of unknown unknowns. And so over time, we've adjusted the suite of instruments to allow us to make more headway on the science. And I'm still saddened that we couldn't do something similar to that with James Webb Space Telescope. But, you know, it's out all the way out at Lagrangian Point 2. And we just don't have a way to get out there and change instruments out. We're just going to have to work with what's there. And those are just great instruments for now. But that Hubble was a example of a very adaptable system, a very general purpose observatory, which has changed over time and allowed us to attune our instrumentation to the latest scientific questions. Pretty cool.
Definitely pretty cool. I mean, it's interesting you're talking about the instruments there, because it was this month, as we're recording, was the 20th anniversary of the advanced camera for surveys. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that and exactly why that's such a big instrument.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the PI for Advanced Camera for Surveys, which is ACS, is Holland Ford, and he's at Johns Hopkins. And interestingly enough, he was my doctoral research advisor when I was at Johns Hopkins. So my second career is in astronomy, and I went to Hopkins with, at the time, the Advanced Camera for Surveys had just been mounted in Hubble Space Telescope, and there was just this beehive of activity at Johns Hopkins around this. But the Advanced Camera for Surveys takes the most recent, most powerful detectors and allows us to do these very large survey observations. And these survey, we're actually going to be launching another spacecraft in 2025 called Roman Space Telescope that will have even broader field of regard. But it allowed Hubble to have its broadest field of regard and to collect statistical information about stars and distribute it on the sky. And it has allowed us to make a lot of progress on some of these big questions about stellar evolution, about planet formation theory. And so that's why that instrument was so terribly important. Still is. It's still very important. And I remember not too many years ago when one of its main power supplies failed on orbit, and we did come up with some solutions right here at Goddard. It's amazing to me what we can do from the ground just by adapting these older systems as they age. Sometimes due to the radiation environment, some of the hardware will just die, and we have workarounds that we can do from the ground.
That's really, really interesting, because you sort of think back to the Hubble servicing missions, and you actually had shuttle astronauts going up and physically fixing and upgrading, but obviously that doesn't happen anymore, but now you can sort of do a lot of it from the ground.
That's right. So when we designed Hubble, it was designed with these built-in redundancies and with, well, almost all of the computers and things were completely redundant, and we're able to, from the ground, adapt as some of those things fail. And so, for instance, the gyros, these are instruments. They're transducers that allow us to sense how the telescope is moving in space. And so we use that to get from one target star to the next. We command the telescope to move from one target to the next, and the gyros tell us how it's moving and such. There's six of those, and they have slowly over time just failed one after the next as anticipated. But we're able to come up with new algorithms to allow us to use fewer. We thought we needed three of these gyros in orthogonal axes to be able to do this task, but we're actually able to do it with just one, using new approaches and using some of the other functionality on the spacecraft. It's really amazing and quite beautiful to see this ingenious adaptations to work with that aging observatory.
Yeah, I mean it does sort of take you back to what you were saying before about the fact that, you know, JWST can't be maintained or serviced if anything should go wrong or any sort of new hardware wants to be added. Did or does that concern you or other JWST scientists?
I have, yes. The JWST scientists have sat up nights, and I know these men and women personally, and they have really been very concerned that on the transit out to this L2, Lagrangian point 2, that these big deployables on JWST perhaps wouldn't work. Any one of those deployables, say the secondary mirror deployable, if that didn't work, it would just be an enormous piece of space junk sitting out there. And we would need to send perhaps a robot to nudge it open or something like that. And I remember when we were originally discussing James Webb Space Telescope, it used to be called the Next Generation Space Telescope, NGST. And I argued that we should deploy everything in low Earth orbit and then gently nudge it out to the Lagrangian point. So if something did go wrong, we could potentially send up people. But the problem with that is, if you'll recall, the Hubble Space Telescope has these grapple points on it. It's the entire observatory is rated for human interactions on it. And that is a very high hurdle. You can't have astronauts come up to a spacecraft that's not designed that way. It puts them in great danger. So before astronauts were even allowed out of the space shuttle, we'd grapple it with the Canadian robotic arm, make sure that everything's settled, and then send them out. There's no mechanism like that on James Webb Space Telescope. It just wasn't designed to be human rated. And so the implications there are, if we had designed it to be grapplable and human rated, it would be very much more expensive. You could easily add another billion to it just for that. So it does trouble many of my colleagues that were not able to service it. But the amazing thing is the dang thing worked. We sent it out to Lagrangian point. All these deployables popped out, just really improbable. Just, it came out of this tiny little package, and it's this absolutely enormous telescope with the mirrors themselves deployed from a small package. I don't know. There was a lot of pucker factor sending that out to L2 without having it deployed before it was gone out there. But it does seem to be coming together really well, and I'm very excited about that science.
This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. When you want the best, you have to act fast, especially when hiring for your business. You want to find the most talented people before the competition scoops them up. And the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds top talent fast. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Spotify. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Want to be more active this summer? Sierra helps you save on everything from swimsuits to stand-up paddle boards, tennis rackets to fishing tackle. And if that doesn't float your boat, we also have pool floats. Sierra, let's get moving. To your local store, like now. Go!
Absolutely. At the time of recording, we've only really just had the sort of calibration images, but it's all looking really good. And I was wanting to sort of go back to exoplanets, because another sort of big milestone that's happened as we were at the time of recording is NASA has just sort of said that we've just passed the 5,000 confirmed exoplanet mark, and I was wanting to get your thoughts on sort of JWST's contribution to exoplanet study and what you're looking forward to from that aspect of the mission.
Right, so JW is going to be looking in the near and mid infrared wavelength ranges. So that can tell us a lot. There's a lot of very interesting biomarkers that you can pick up in that range. And so biomarkers are, well, if you can imagine, there's 4 principal biomarkers that we look for. These are molecular lines that you see in the spectrum of the atmosphere of a planet. And if any of those are out of equilibrium in the atmosphere, that suggests that something's going on there. Each of those biomarkers, there are geological processes that can produce an out of equilibrium state for them individually. But if you get all four of them, then that's almost certainly life. So you've identified life on that planet, because life is what generates all four of these. And just so you would see those indications in the atmosphere, and you're going to see that in the near and mid infrared. So there are, even though James Webb Space Telescope really wasn't designed to look for exoplanets, primarily looking for, you know, the first stars, the very early universe, which is all at very high redshift. So the very most distant parts of the universe that are far back in time, 13 billion years or so, maybe 13 billion years ago, these wavelengths have all been stretched very far into the infrared. And that's what JW is really designed to help us look for. We'll be looking at a number of things, looking for something called baryonic acoustic oscillation, which is something that was supposed to have happened very early in the universe, essentially sound waves rattling around in this ball of hot plasma shortly after the universe began. So once the universe cooled enough for the electrons that had formed to bind with the protons, all of the photons went flying out of this ball of plasma, and those acoustic waves rattling around in this ball of plasma are still now, they are imprinted on those photons. And we can tell a lot about things like dark energy and dark matter from that. So I'm just really excited to find out, especially, well, we have this telescope called the Roman Space Telescope, which is also going to help a lot with that. It's going to try to help us understand about dark energy in particular, which still mystifies me. I really have no idea what that is, and it's not my science either. Just pretty lost when I get to talking to people about it. But
yeah, this is the telescope that it used to be called WFIRST, didn't it? Is it the same telescope?
Yep, it had this fairly unimaginative name called WFIRST, which is Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope. Fairly bland. We usually do that when it's in development, and then once it gets closer and we're into phase A, where we're actually designing and putting things together, then we'll give it a name. And in this case, it was named after Nancy Grace Roman, who is this absolute giant in the world of astrophysics. So named after her.
Yes, and one of the things that it really blew my mind when I was sort of looking into that mission, it must have been about a year or two ago when I sort of first came across that mission, when it was called WFIRST, was this notion of detecting exoplanets via microlensing. I was wondering if you could just explain a bit about that, because it just sounds like absolute science fiction.
It really does, and it's absolutely improbable sounding. So let me try to create an image in your mind and your listeners. So if you can imagine a universe where there's exactly one star and nothing else in it. So you have one star in the center of this otherwise completely black universe. You are a massless observer, so some sort of godlike being. You're flying around and you're observing this star, right? And you're looking at the star and it's just sitting there doing absolutely nothing. Let's suppose this is a very nice quiescent star. It's doing absolutely nothing. All of the light rays are coming directly radially out from the star because, of course, space-time is just flat because there's only one mass in it, the star. So now imagine a second mass. You introduce a second mass that comes between you and this distant star. It could be a black hole, might be a neutron star, free-floating planet, or a planet that's in a bound orbit about a star. That comes between you and that distant star that was the only one in the universe. Now suddenly, the gravitation, the mass of that intervening object will warp space-time. And it causes the dilation of time around it. So the closer you are to a large mass, time moves slower. And light always takes the path of least time. So what that means is light rays that were traveling radially away from that distant star now have to curve inwards to take that path of least time, because the time is slowed down around this new mass. And that is very much like what a lens does. If you can, in your mind's eye, think of just your typical convex lens, just like the one you used to fry ants with when you're a boy, that it's as if you passed a lens in front of that distant light source now. But instead of having the index of refraction of a piece of glass cause this warping or this this change in the trajectory of these light beams, it's actually the warping of space-time that does that. So you can tell a lot about the intervening mass by how it affects the light from this very distant source. And that is gravitational microlensing. So we can pick up things like this recent detection of a stellar mass black hole using this technique. It doesn't have to emit light. It can just be a piece of nothing like this solar mass black hole, but it actually causes this warping of space-time that we can detect and tell a lot about the object. And it's really important because the gravitational microlensing, this technique, is very sensitive to planets that are from the habitable zone about a star on out to unbound planets. So if you can imagine planets getting further and further away from their host star until they're just no longer affected by the gravitation and they're just floating through space by themselves. Theory tells us that these planets are almost twice as common as stars in our galaxy. So say it's 200 billion stars in the Milky Way, so 400 billion free-floating planets. Just, and some of these could be like brilliant places for life to begin. Very quiescent, giant planets with thick envelopes of gas, very like Jupiter. And so they, for eons, they could have this very quiet, quiescent environment where life can begin. It's a very, very cutting edge idea in science right now. And so gravitational microlensing tells us a lot about this regime of planets from the habitable zone about a star on out to unbound planets. And there's no other technique that allows us to do that, except for, of course, there's direct imaging of planets, but that is just really hard. Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope will be a pathfinder for a kind of observation to allow us to do these direct detection of planets around other stars. That's just really hard to do. So this is a pathfinder, but it's just very, very exciting.
It really is. And it sort of seems like one of many exoplanet missions that are going to be launched. I mean, the European Space Agency has quite a lot coming up over the next 10, 20 years.
A Euclid for one thing. So
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Euclid. That's an interesting one. It'll be working in the visible wavelengths, and it actually, its primary purpose in life is to look for evidence to help us understand dark energy. However, we can repurpose it to look for exoplanets using specifically gravitational microlensing. So one of the projects that we're working on is to combine Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope with Euclid to get something called microlensing parallax. And that will allow us to detect and get the masses of free-floating planets. Very cool. It's just, that's just bleeding-edge science right there.
So given all these amazing techniques and the amount of missions that are going to be launched, are you optimistic about the prospect of us actually being able to detect life on an exoplanet within our lifetime, for example, if it's there?
Yeah, I expect. Well, I'm going to put myself out there and say that we should have evidence of life somewhere outside of Earth, probably within the next decade. So certainly within your lifetime, I would say within the next 10 years, because it's a profound confluence of science and technology. So our understanding of where to look for life, together with the technology to permit us to make the necessary measurements to find life. And that is all coming to fruition right now in this epoch. So to clarify, I'm not talking about fancy life. So life that can communicate. This is the kind of life that you you scrape off the bottom of your shoes after a walk in the park, that kind of life. So just blorps of some horribleness on a rock. But it will still have, you know, and it could be on Mars. It could be on one of the moons of the exterior giant planets, or it could be from JW or Hubble Space Telescope, making measurements of biomarkers in planetary atmospheres. But within the next 10 years or so, I'd venture that we'll find scientifically compelling evidence of life off planet. And there are, of course, there are concerns about the possibility of civil unrest when this happens. I'm beginning to write a book on that, about, you know, getting thought leaders, especially in religious thought leaders, to give their thoughts on, okay, this is going to happen soon. What do you think? So that's kind of a project that I've begun work on. And I thought I maybe would start with my own podcast and just set some people down. It's like, okay, well, what do you think? How is your constituency going to react when this happens? It's not a question in my mind of if it's going to happen. It's when. There are something like, what is it, 72 septillion stars in the universe. And now what science tells us is that planets are at least, well, approximately twice as common as stars. And that's just free-floating planets. We find that most stars have a retinue of planets. And in my opinion, the universe is just going to be replete with life. And I like to think of life as almost a state of matter. You have solid, gas, liquid, and life. So given the right conditions for long enough time, life will just arise. And we're going to find it really soon, certainly within our lifetimes.
What do you do when you find it, but it's on an exoplanet, you know, that's too far away to send a probe to within one person's lifetime?
Yeah. So when confronted with that, I always feel a little bit forlorn. It's sad that the distances between stars are so vast, but we can tell an awful lot just from these signatures. And it can tell us a lot about the rarity and the preciousness of life on our planet. I think a lot more, and will make us really reflect on the vastness of space and the preciousness of life on our planet. And that's my takeaway all the time. I look up at the stars and I think about us. I think about home. So that will be one of the principal takeaways. It's like, well, how common is life in the universe, and how common is intelligent life, and how rare is humankind and the other intelligent species like dolphins and whales and octopi? How common are those sorts of things? It's really a new golden age for astronomy right now. I mean, and if you think about it just for a minute, so right now in all of human history, we are alone in the universe, right? Up until this present time, we're completely alone. We have no evidence, no scientifically compelling evidence that there's life anywhere else in the universe right now. In about 10 years, that will change forever. Suddenly, we're not going to be alone in the universe. So that will be really childhood's end for humankind, to be now recognize that we're part of a universe that is just replete with life, and all those possibilities from that. That's happening now while you and I are alive. And it's just amazing. It's profound.
It really is. I mean, I know you're a big fan of Carl Sagan, and it does bring you back to, his famous pale blue dots speech. And it's the idea that As a human being, when you're going about your life, to you, planet Earth is the universe, and all the sort of trivial things that you think about in your day to day. But if you take the time to say, for example, observe a bird landing on the branch of a tree, And you just think, we don't know of anywhere else where anything even remotely as beautiful or complex as that is happening.
Yeah, and I think it has great importance for people to take the time to do that. You know, just go out at night, look up at the stars, and reflect on the rarity of life and the immediacy of these beautiful things, the very shortness of life. And it's important to put yourself in the universe and to realize that Earth is not, well, it's special, but it's not a particular perch where that's central to the universe at all. So it's important to get your head around that idea that the Earth just isn't the center of the universe. And to confront that issue just by looking at the stars and then looking at the beauty of life around you. And that's not to say that I'm some sort of atheist. I am not. So I don't know if we even want to go on that adventure, but...
thinking even further into the future, you know, JWST and the Roman Telescope, where do we go after that? Can we send or should we send space telescopes further out into space? Is there benefit in doing that? Should we put observatories on the moon?
Question, and we have done a lot of thinking about it. Actually, my own dissertation, which I did back in 2008 at Johns Hopkins, we were working on something called a long baseline stellar interferometer. And I was being specifically groomed for something called the terrestrial planet finder interferometer. And so what this thing is, you take two or more telescopes and you intercept light from very distant objects, say a planet around a star. And I don't know if you remember Young's double slit experiment from high school physics. When you have two slits in a screen, you get this interference pattern from a distant object. Okay. And so the interference pattern has places where it's constructive and places where it's destructive. So if you move the telescope such that the destructive part of that interference pattern is right over the central star, then you can see the faint material around the star, including planets. And this will be very necessary in the future to look and assess and characterize planets with life on them. That's going to happen. We're going to have to build that. In 2010, it was set aside because it's just technically monstrously difficult. But all of the amazing technology that we have created for James Webb Space Telescope will be part of that. One of the reasons why James Webb is fairly expensive for a space mission, we had to develop things from whole cloth, things that are just really improbable, step and hold actuators, how to phase all these gigantic mirrors and make them into one big mirror. All those types of technologies will now allow us to build things like a long baseline stellar interferometer. One of my colleagues actually wants to put one on the moon. It'd be a very good, very good spot to put one. So that's on down the line. Once we have this detection of life that I think will be happening very soon, there's going to be a lot of excitement around that. And we'll go back and revisit these techniques. And that's pretty much where astronomy is headed right now.
Fantastic. Well, it seems like there's going to be a lot to look forward to in the next few decades. And then I'm really looking forward to it, as I'm sure you are too. But I think that's about all the time we have. I just want to say thanks very much for speaking to me today, Richard, coming on the podcast and sharing with us your insight and expertise. It's been amazing talking to you.
Great, Ian. I really enjoyed talking to you, and I hope your listeners enjoyed it. We have some really nice websites at NASA, and I have my own website that I go into a little more detail about how microlensing works. It might be worth the look.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.